House Committee on Judiciary come to order today is Thursday, March 9th.
That's not good.
We're going to go out of order today off the agenda a little bit. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2698 and call Representative Kenemer, David Vereens, and Brenda Hyatt, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2698 allows a person with more than one conviction in the preceding 10 years to file a motion to set aside that conviction 3 years after judgment, provided that the other convictions arise out of the same criminal episode.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you for this hearing. I'm State Representative Bill Kenemer, House District 39, and I've sponsored House Bill 2698 on behalf of a friend, David Breams. Most of us believe good justice requires sentences that balance punishment and consequences with hope to rehabilitation and a return to responsible citizenship. And that's really what House Bill 2698 is all about. Under our current system of strong penalties, with multiple convictions stemming from the same episode, a person cannot get an expungement for 10 years. And I do support strong sentences to discourage misconduct. On the other hand, as a legislator and a retired psychologist who spent most of his life helping people rise above their problems, I think good public policy must also support rehabilitation. And that's the heart of this bill. David Breams is one so affected, and through his experience, he can do a better job than I in explaining this important bill. And through correspondence we received last night, we've become aware of a couple of small concerns, and we have an amendment being drafted literally as we speak. And Mr. Breams will also speak to that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Committee, for hearing me today. In 2011...
You need to state your name for the record.
Oh, my name is David Eugene Breams.
Thank you.
In 2011, an event happened that changed my life completely. In other words, I'd say topsy-turvy compared to the route that I was taking. Most of my life, I always tried to follow some kind of judicial path. When I was 15, I joined the Police Explorer program until I was 18 years old. From 18, I went and got with a rather large security industry and continued my path through the criminal justice way. I then moved to Portland, Oregon, and continued my education in the criminal justice, was almost finished with my degree in criminal justice and juvenile psychology when 2011 hit and an event changed. Like anybody else, I was in my 20s, my late 20s. I, you know, had my various traffic infractions, probably bought some cars that I probably shouldn't have that caused those. But I never imagined myself being arrested or being jailed or taken away from my family, because that taking care of them and taking care of myself was my whole life. I'm not going to get into the details of what the charges were, because in the eyes of the law, and the outcome of my case, I was found guilty, and therefore that was the end of it. But I didn't let that day or that event stop my life. I continued to push through. I decided to go and talk to my teachers and my professors, and I changed my degree to go to business management and to finish my education and push on. I told myself that no matter what the outcome was, I was going to continue. I ended up volunteering in my community, Boy Scouts, T-ball, softball. I bought a house in the community that I've lived in now for the last 9 years. I give to the businesses in my community. I really believe in bettering oneself. In this stance, and what I brought to 2698 was a chance for true first-time offenders to be able to rebuild themselves without the stigma of being a criminal for 10 years on stacked crimes. And in order to do that, I asked for some amendments to my bill that makes it so that if someone is truly wanting to change and be a better person, then they will show proof of that to show proof of embedderment and community support. And some of the amendments that I have asked for is community involvement, job placement, so being placed at one job, not bouncing around, residential history, showing that you've lived in one place for a long period of time, higher education is some of the few that I've asked to be added to the law. I'm not saying that a person that has a stacked crime did or did not do more crimes than what a person that only committed a simple theft charge of a candy bar or whatever got him in trouble in the first place. I'm saying that if it's truly a first offender, then that person deserves a chance to rebuild within 3 years and not 10 years and keep that stigmatism of, you know, that he did wrong. I'm saying that he needs to work harder and show more proof to be able to earn that early that early expungement and show that he's not just sliding through the law waiting for his time to come up so he can go and do bad again. That this bill is not for people that already had some kind of conviction on their record. It's not for people that already had an expungement erased off their record, because the courts can still see the expungement. It's designed to make it so employers and rentals and place like that can't see the expungement. So I'm not asking that everybody gets to be expunged. I'm asking only the true first-time offenders that truly made a mistake. They woke up that morning and for whatever reason their brain was not where their brain was supposed to be, and they truly made a mistake and it was never going to happen again. I am now celebrating 10 years married to my wife. I am celebrating 10 years of owning my company and continuing to run the same company that I was running when I got in trouble. That was another thing that did not stop me. I found rules and spoke with our licensing agency in trying to find a position for me in the company that made it so I did not step on the security toes, but I could still run the company and control my officers in their job. And there's only a certain few that can say that they're rehabilitated and it was truly a first-time offense. And the courts will easily be able to pick those two out of the line, you know, because the true person that truly made a mistake is going to show the history through that 3 years and on to the rest of his life that, you know, that was a one-time thing and will never be repeated again by the actions he's taking to better himself and better the community.
Thank you. Okay. My name is Brenda Hyatt, H-I-A-T-T. Chairman Barker and members of this committee, I'm here today to support 2698. Hopefully my voice will hold out for a few minutes. I don't like crime in any way. I don't think any of us do. I appreciate harsher sentences. I appreciate people being taken off of the street for when they're committing crimes. We all watch the news. It doesn't take much to understand that we have a gang problem, we have a theft problem, we have all kinds of problems. But what this bill supports is it supports the DA has in his arsenal what they call crime stacking. Okay, and what that is for is so that somebody goes out and commits an assault. They can not only be charged with assault, they can be charged with menacing, they can be charged with attempted assault. And that way there's three different crimes. Okay? Through the testimony that I have, that we pulled up for the opposition this morning, I have some serious concerns. Crime stacking occurs in almost every crime that is charged in this country because they use it to get enhanced sentences. They use it to get stronger sentences where they might only be able to get a 5-year sentence with crime stacking than get a 15 or 20 year sentence. And there are cases where that's necessary. All of us have seen them on TV. All of us have seen them. You know, some of us have had experience with them in our day-to-day lives. But there are also times when that's not necessary. Well, one of the things that came across the desk this morning was that this is going to undo hundreds of plea bargains. The ability to expunge one's record was never meant to use as a hammer to force somebody into a plea bargain. Regardless of the outcome of your case, if you choose to go to trial, that should be your choice. You may be found guilty if you choose to go to trial. You're taking your chance with a judge, you're taking your chance with a jury. But you should not have to be forced into pleading guilty to a charge in order to qualify for expungement in 3 years. Just so that if you do go to trial and are found guilty of 2, 3, 4, 5 charges on the same crime, that you can't get an expungement for 5 years, or I mean for 10 years. You're no less guilty if you take a plea bargain than you are if you go to trial. Using the expungement laws as a hammer to force a plea bargain is not the way these laws were intended, nor is it the correct way to use them. 2698 focuses on rehabilitation. With the new amendment that will be coming down after this session, legislative council said probably early next week, it's going to set a standard by which a person who is accused and convicted of multiple crimes from the same event is going to have to live their life. Their previous life prior to their crime is going to have to be clean, other than maybe a traffic offense or something like that. Their life after their conviction is going to have to be exemplary. They're going to have to better themselves with school and community involvement and education. They're not just going to be able to get out of jail and coexist in the same lifestyle they lived in before. And by setting that standard, you're setting the standard higher than you would set it for the person who got accused of shoplifting that soda that they didn't have 75 cents to afford. You're setting a standard that will give them the ability to shoot for a desired goal. They're going to look at this and they're going to say, maybe I can do this. Maybe it's worth getting my GED. Maybe it's worth getting my college degree. Maybe it's even worth settling down and actually taking part in my children's lives with something other than child support. You know, maybe it's worth me becoming a person because I can get a second chance after 3 years. The problem with our system is, and I don't think anybody can deny this, a person getting out of jail in this day and age with computers and criminal background checks is causing a higher recidivism rate. They can't get houses, they can't get apartments, they can't get jobs. They're forced to get jobs as part of their parole and probation. But how many employers realistically hire people with criminal backgrounds? I'm I'm a co-owner in a business, in a security company. I don't care if you committed any kind of a misdemeanor or a crime. No matter how good you've done, I can't hire you unless that misdemeanor is 7 years old and most felonies are 10 years old and there's a list of disqualifiers as long as I am tall, as there should be. But this would give a person a chance at rehabilitation after 3 years, after showing that they're willing to hold a job, showing that they're willing to better themselves and better their communities. It gives them something to look forward to. I had to tell a kid I couldn't hire him because he had a theft recharge on his record. It was a disqualifier for 7 years. I don't believe he ever went in for expungement. He could have. And it's a shame because that makes a whole sector of our workforce unemployable. I have presented you with testimony today, written testimony, and about a third of what I've said is on there, but I believe you guys are capable of reading, so I did not sit here and read my testimony. I'm just telling you from my heart of hearts that I believe our system was not intended to put people back on the street so they could be used as an example of what not to do, so that they could be set up for failure before they're ever released from jail, so they have nothing to look forward to. I believe our system was set up for rehabilitation and to try and give these people back their lives as soon as possible. And if they don't want it, they'll show it. And our criminal justice system will get them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Your questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just add, Brenda, I don't think mentioned she is David's mother. So that's a logical connection. And she and I have worked on a lot of legislation across the years. Thank you very much
Thank
for
you,
your attention
Brenda.
To this important Thank matter.
Next call, Brian Brock and Jeff Lowell.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barker, council members. My name is Brian Brock. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with Clackamas County. I've been there for 17 years, and I was the prosecutor on Mr. Bream's case, and I was asked to come speak to you about the facts of his case, as well as how his case went through the judicial system, to both illustrate the concept of what a criminal episode is and how this particular bill applies to a very broad range of conduct, and in fact, probably conduct that you might not necessarily think that it would encompass. And many examples, I'm sure, that I haven't even thought of that this bill would apply to that might surprise you in its both application and its breadth. So I'll first talk about the facts of the case, and then once I received the case, kind of how it worked its way through the system. And then I briefly want to talk about the different ways that this case could have gone and how the system, the checks and the balances and the appeals and so forth are all there to ensure that the defendant gets a fair trial. Back in 2011, Mr. Breams was at a business up in Sandy by the name of Stephenson's Automotive. He'd had his vehicle towed there for repairs, and he got an estimate for the vehicle that he didn't like, and he was so displeased with that he ended up getting into a yelling match with Amanda, who was the front office lady who didn't even do the estimate, about the appropriateness of that bill. And so they told him, as is his right, that he could have it towed to another place to have an estimate done, and that's what he was choosing to do. So when he arrived there, they gave him his keys. He went into the front lobby to get them. And at that point, Amanda had told both her father, who is Mr. Stevenson and runs the automotive shop, as well as some other people about the conversation that she'd had. And so he wasn't given a very warm welcome there, but he was given his keys, and he was not satisfied. But what they didn't know was that he was armed with a concealed weapon. He did not have a concealed weapons permit at that time and was not allowed to carry it openly. And so everyone that was in that lobby was unaware of the fact that they were dealing with somebody who was carrying a Glock handgun on his left hip. As he left the automobile repair shop and went into the parking lot, he had to wait for about an hour for the tow truck that he had requested to come tow his car. And during that time, his frustration built, clearly, as evidenced in his conversations with his insurance, who was, with the AAA, who was arranging for the tow. Finally, the victim in this case, who happened to be a tow truck driver, but was not the tow truck driver that he had, that was being dispatched to get his car. He happened to be towing someone else's car there. But he knew Amanda. Amanda was like a sister to him, and he'd heard what had happened with Amanda. And so he decided to strike up a conversation with Mr. Breams. And there was some dispute about exactly how that conversation went, and I'm not here to say how that conversation did go. But the testimony from Mr. Martin was that he basically told him he should leave. He didn't appreciate the language and how he treated Amanda. But it was clear, because there was an independent eyewitness to this, someone who didn't know either of them, and this would have been the tow truck driver that was dispatched for Mr. Breams' car, who witnessed this conversation and the fact that it was that at no time did Mr. Martin reach into the vehicle or make any kind of threats to Mr. Breams. The second tow truck driver arrives just as the incident that gives rise to the other charges in this case occurred, which is that Mr. Breams told Mr. Martin to back away, which he did not, and then he proceeded to open up the door and slam it into his head. He then got out of the vehicle, drew his Glock, and pointed it at Mr. Martin, and again commanded him to back away. Now, there was a trial on this matter, and certainly there it was a disputed trial, but there was an independent eyewitness that confirmed all of this, and that is why Mr. Breams was convicted, was that Mr. Levy, who was actually Mr. Breams' tow truck driver, arrived and witnessed this. Described the gun in detail, described the barrel, the shape, the color. He even guessed it was one of three models, one of which was a Glock. It was also described by Mr. Martin in detail. The police arrived and disarmed Mr. Breams within minutes when 911 was called, and he denied drawing the gun. He acknowledged opening the door and said he did it to get Mr. Martin away from him, claimed that Mr. Martin had reached into the vehicle and grabbed him, and that he was defending himself in opening the door to create some distance. All refuted by both the victim as well as the independent eyewitness, Mr. Breams' tow truck driver. The case was charged by myself after receiving reports documenting those facts as I've described them to you, and I've been doing this for 17 years. I've never heard the term stacking charges. It's not a term that I've ever used, but I understand now it being used, the concept that they're speaking about. It's always been my philosophy to charge those charges that apply to the case and that I can prove beyond a reasonable doubt and that represent the conduct. Most of my cases, I charge one count. I now supervise the misdemeanor unit, but when I was working in the misdemeanor unit, it was always our philosophy that you didn't add on charges that don't represent any additional conduct, that don't add any dimension to the case, and that a judge or a jury will see as overreaching if you do so. And that's a mistake that people make once and then you stop doing it. So I elected to charge him among four counts, the first one being unlawful use of a weapon, which was the drawing and pointing of the firearm at Mr. Martin. Assault in the fourth degree, because as a result of slamming the car door into Mr. Martin's head, he received a contusion on his forehead. Menacing for placing Mr. Breams in fear of imminent serious physical injury and of being shot. I forgot to add the fact that this Glock was loaded and there was a round in the chamber, which Chief Yamashita discovered after she seized the weapon and chambered slid the action on the gun, that it was but a finger trigger away from firing into Mr. Martin. And then I also charged unlawful possession of a firearm because as he went into the automotive repair shop, he was carrying his handgun concealed on his persons, and he was doing so without a concealed license permit. Mr. Breams is familiar with this, of course, because he has been certified by the DPST and holds certifications both as a armed and unarmed professional as well as an unarmed instructor. And after I charged this case, there was some negotiations and some discussions, and much of the mitigation that you heard about his life, his family, his job, I was aware of all of that. And I was very mindful of the fact that Mr. Breams had no criminal history and that otherwise was a law-abiding citizen. But on the other side, as an individual charged with the duty to protect the community from what I perceived as being very irresponsible conduct for an armed citizen, which is his right, but when you're irresponsible with a handgun, I felt it was my duty to respond appropriately. And I selected charges, and there certainly could have been more than this, but charges that represented each one of the violations of the criminal code that reflected the conduct. I would argue that certainly, even under this bill, Mr. Breams might not be able to get this expunged because the unlawful possession of a weapon seems to me to be a separate criminal episode than these other crimes. Certainly it took place in a different location and were separated by some amount of time. That would be an issue that would be argued, but I want to point out the fact that this would be one that you might not think should be covered by this bill, but it would be. And in fact, Mr. Breams, should this bill pass, could move for expungement today or as soon as it becomes effective. Now, I want to talk about how the case proceeded through the system. I did actually bring the plea offer that I made, and I don't remember all the details of it, but my plea offer, which was an attempt to take into account his particular situation and the mitigation that was provided to me by his defense attorney, was to plead to one of those four counts, and I would dismiss all the remaining ones. And that was the unlawful use of a weapon, which was the most serious charge, and it is the felony. But if for all of those who are familiar with the expungement statutes, he would be able to expunge that in 3 years. And so after 3 years, if he successfully expunged that, he would no longer be a felon. He would no longer have any crimes on his record. Now, that, in my opinion now, as I'm sure was then, was a very generous offer, but it took into account the seriousness of his conduct, the risk that he represented to the community, that when you draw a gun, there's an inherent danger, not only that you should never draw a gun, let alone load it or not, and point it at an individual that you do not intend to shoot. It is one of the fundamental pieces that you learn in firearm safety. And he violated that, unless he intended to actually shoot Mr. Martin, which I hope that he did not. Had he, you know, it could be an attempted murder if he had. But I also felt that because he caused physical injury to Mr. Breams, that an assault needed to be charged. How does one overlook that fact? The menacing, now, you know, that's one that I suppose it to some degree is enfolded into the unlawful use of a weapon, because unlawful use of a weapon is the possession or use of a weapon in an unlawful fashion, and the unlawful fashion in this case was the menacing. So in some ways, the menacing is part and parcel of the unlawful use of a weapon. He turned down that offer, and there were really no counteroffers that were ever made because he did not feel that he committed a crime. And that is his right, and that is why we had a trial. But certainly, we in plea negotiations, in plea offers, try to encourage those people that are willing to take responsibility, to own up to what they did, that they will get a significant benefit in doing so. And so Mr. Breams went to trial and was found guilty of all of those charges. Now, upon sentencing, the judge can, under certain circumstances, and I'm not going to get into the merger statutes because, quite frankly, I don't always understand them. They're very complicated. But the point is that many, if you want to talk about stacking charges, charges that are stacked that really don't belong there will end up getting merged by the sentencing judge. And in this case, none of these convictions ended up merging because they were all separate, not criminal episodes, but separate violations of the criminal code that represent discrete violations of the law. Now, to further elaborate on how the system works, Mr. Breams filed an appeal and appealed that conviction. His appeal was affirmed without opinion so he was convicted October of 2011, and as I may have overlooked, the incident occurred January 31st of 2011. Good news being, we do get cases to trial pretty quickly in Clackamas County within less than 10 months. Unfortunately, it took 2 years for the Court of Appeals to affirm that conviction, but in September 2013, it was affirmed. He then appealed that to the Supreme Court, and in November of 2014, they denied review. He then filed back in the circuit court post-conviction relief, which for those of you are not familiar with, that is yet one more level of appeal wherein you get to challenge how well your attorney did, essentially. I did print out his post-conviction petition because I thought it was interesting, the allegations for why he should have a new trial or his convictions vacated. And then it was the typical ineffective assistance of counsel, in other words, that his lawyer was at fault for his convictions. But his second claim for relief was prosecutorial misconduct, coaching witnesses, and suborning perjury.
Very close, Mr. Chair.
So if we could appreciate the summary, but if you could wrap it up.
Sure can.
Got it towards the bill.
So the post-conviction relief was denied, and then he appealed that, and that, I believe, has also been denied. I illustrate all of that just to show you the different opportunities that individuals have to challenge their convictions, to challenge the effectiveness of their attorneys and so forth, and the opportunities that individuals have to negotiate their cases, and that even in circumstances where they are charged with multiple offenses, we are mindful of the expungement statutes and the ability to someone to expunge their convictions after a period of time. And I believe that that process works. I believe that Mr. Breams had a fair chance. He has been rightfully convicted. And as a result of that, yes, he will have to wait 10 years that he can expunge everything that I just described to you and no longer have any of these convictions. But I think it would have been wrong to have all of that wiped away within 3 years. Certainly, I know his victims wouldn't feel that that was appropriate. And I don't think that carrying a firearm within 3 years of this incident was an appropriate response to his conduct.
Hey, thank you. Add anything, or?
Yes, I do.
Okay, direct to the bill,
yes.
Please.
Chair Barker, members of this committee, my name is Jeffrey Michael Lowe, L-O-W-E. I'm a deputy district attorney with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I've been employed there for 17 years as a deputy district attorney. I'm here on behalf of that office as well as the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and we are here opposed to House Bill 2698. This would be a significant departure for the state of Oregon. We have a set-aside statute, 137.225. It has been in existence since 1971. It was much shorter then. And at that time, it stated a person convicted of more than one offense, excluding motor vehicle violations, whether the second or additional conviction occurred in the same action, in which convictions as to which relief is sought occurred or in another action. So from the get-go, we were looking at multiple charges out of the same incident and saying no to that. In this case, in 1971, in your entire life, you could only get one conviction set aside, and that was it. Tinkering to the statute proceeded immediately, and in 1974, in a special session, we had our first tinkering with 137.225. In 1975, the statute was again amended, and at that time, we included in that portion the 10-year period immediately preceding, meaning that if you had more than two convictions, you'd have to wait for 10 years. We kept the language in the statute at that time to include episodes in the same criminal episode, and has been there ever since. There have been many, many, many amendments to the statute, and I was a part of the 2015 rewrite that attempted to consolidate the statute. We took into account prior convictions for violations, and we made an exception so that a person convicted of a violation could still get their misdemeanor or felony conviction that was eligible set aside after only 3 years. That was something that Mr. Bassos from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office and I worked out in negotiations over an extended period of time. That conversation, as in many conversations about this particular statute, goes for months and sometimes years with committees talking back and forth because we all have a hard time agreeing what is the best thing for the people of the state of Oregon with regards to erasing a person's history. because ultimately that's what this statute does. It erases a person's history. In some cases, we feel that's a good idea because a person had an incident, time has gone by, and nothing else has happened, and they are at that point deserving of having it set aside. We've made that exception in our law. But sometimes, sometimes history should not disappear. To quote Oregon Justice Lindy in State versus Langen, which was a case on this particular statute, he said, "The statutory history leaves no doubt that the legislature chose a policy in favor of setting aside the convictions of qualified applicants rather than leaving the decision to judicial discretion." What that means is that there's little to no discretion under the statute. If you qualify, regardless of how good or how bad you are, you're going to get your matter set aside if it is eligible. There's only one small section for enumerated crimes that gives the judge the ability to just kind of weigh, well, maybe this isn't such a good idea based upon all this other evidence I'm hearing. Those charges include things like abandonment of child, attempted assault in the second degree, assault in the third degree, coercion, attempted escape in the first degree, attempted assault in the second degree, incest, intimidation in the first degree, attempted kidnapping in the second degree, attempted robbery in the second degree, robbery in the third degree, supplying contraband, and unlawful use of a weapon. Any amendment that happens to this particular statute needs to be carefully considered because their ramifications are considerable for our society. And in this case, if this amendment passes, the episode that you've heard about, Mr. Brames, amongst many others, would have the ability at that time to be set aside. Currently, if a person was convicted of theft in the second degree and criminal mischief in the second degree, running into Fred Meyer, going to steal some stuff, I damage it on my way out, I get arrested, and I get charged with theft and criminal mischief. If I'm convicted of both charges, that's going to stay there for 10 years. Seems like a petty crime, but yes, it's going to stay there for 10 years. Another incident that would have the same effect under Oregon law is if I, the jilted lover, find my girlfriend with her new boyfriend, I go into the house, because I've been living there, and I assault both of them. I'm charged with assaulting both. I'm convicted of assault in the fourth degree against two different victims. This statute, as it is written now, would allow that person to set aside his convictions after only 3 years. There are a few cases in law right now that delve into this particular issue. There was the State versus Jensen in 2005, where the defendant sought a set aside for forgery and third-degree theft in October of 2000. And the trial court granted it, saying, "What I'm going to do is merge these two offenses, find that you qualify and grant your motion." The state appealed, and the Court of Appeals reversed the trial court's decision. And the trial court noted, or the appellate court noted, the trial court apparently had attempted to effect a post-conviction merger of two convictions. We have a merger statute. It's actually an anti-merger statute, as many people refer to it, and sometimes it shows up in case law. Because under Oregon law, under our case law, if a charge is stacked, as you've heard today, like four counts of murder, which is a bad example because it could never be set aside, but if we had different theories of a particular crime and we alleged all of those and we were convicted of all of them, the court must merge those sentences. We didn't feel that all situations should allow for that. And so a law was passed. And it's codified at Oregon Revised Statutes 167.067. In cases where the same criminal conduct or criminal episode violates two or more statutory provisions, each provision requires a proof of an element, those will not be merge for the purposes of sentencing. If you have multiple victims, it will not be merged for the purposes of sentencing. And if it's the same victim and the same sort of crime, like three counts of rape three, those will not merge as long as there's sufficient pause, which is built into the statute. That's important because several years ago in State versus Jensen, a 2016 case, the defendant, who was 18 at the time, was convicted of two counts of rape in the third degree and sought a set-aside of his rape three convictions after just 3 years. He was no longer eligible. He wasn't registered as a sex offender because the court did not allow that. They said he didn't need to. He met all the requirements under our statute. And so they granted it, and we sought an appeal, and it was reversed because that cannot happen under the current statute. These cases, it doesn't really get into the policy of why we have it. The policy, the reason we have this, is we do believe people should get a fresh start, should get their record cleared. But we're very aware as prosecutors that our responsibility is not just to making certain the defendants are properly charged, but that we're taking care of victims, that we're serving the interests of society through making certain that justice is served. Sometimes that means we enter into plea negotiations. I've been a prosecutor for 17 years. Prior to that, I was an intern at the Multnomah County DA's office. Sometime the second or third day that I was in the lower room negotiating cases, I learned of the significance between a person pleading guilty to one crime versus two crimes. It's a part of every one of our conversations as we negotiate cases, because we're quite aware. And the reason it's important is because judges have no discretion. They don't get to hear about the facts of the case when they're considering whether or not to grant a set-aside. They only look at whether or not they qualify, because time has passed. And that is why we feel it is still important to take into account cases where people have multiple convictions out of the same criminal episode, because those cases, they're different. There's more at stake. And we're not saying, and the law is not saying, that they can't get that set aside. They can, but they're going to wait a little bit longer. They're going to wait 10 years instead of 3 years. We have a number of statutes that looked to people's history. Criminal history is important. I know that people fear the idea of us looking at propensity, the idea that once you've done something bad, you're going to do it again. But the statute is, and our laws are replete with this idea. We limit it during the course of trials. Sometimes it's appropriate. Most of the times it's not. But when it is, we argue for it, because it's an important thing to know what a person has done before, what they're thinking. We look to it for future dangerousness when we're considering a person's sentence. So if their convictions have been set aside, we're never going to see that, and that's not going to go into the equation for future dangerousness. Under Oregon Revised Statutes 147.421, it's titled Information About Defendant That Public Body Is Required to Provide to Victim. Victims have rights in Oregon. We have a bill in our Constitution. We have a statute. And one of the things that victims get to hear from us and from other public bodies is the prior criminal history of the defendant. Oregon Revised Statutes 166.412 is the criminal history background check for gun dealers. They're required to make certain a person qualifies. When your record is expunged, they're not going to see it. We have a society where we have interests that are not necessarily together, but are at odds. We have employers, people at banks and grocery stores and daycares and hospitals that need to know this information when they're making an employment decision. If I'm working for a bank, I might want to know a person has been convicted of 5 counts of theft in the first degree. If I'm working at a daycare, I'm the employer there, I may want to know that a person has been convicted of 2 assaults. We empathize with people that need to change their life and are changing their life and have gone through the system and worked their way to that. But we believe the statute should remain the way it is at this time, because those incidents where there's more than one event happening in that criminal episode and more than one victim, those cases should wait for 10 years. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Vile.
Well, first I need to say that I feel like I should get at least an hour's worth of continuing legal education for that discourse. And I appreciate very much that we've got 34 years of experience sitting here in front of us. I'm curious, though, with that 34 years of experience, if you can tell me how many cases fit the one that we heard today, where it appears that the action all arose out of the same conduct. It was the conduct of pulling a gun on somebody that got the charges and ending up with multiple charges. How often is that the case that we see folks being denied an early resolution?
Well, I can't speak to how many that is, but I will tell you that there are specific laws that require a prosecutor, when filing an information or indictment, that there must be proper joinder in those cases. In fact, we have laws that dictate what that joinder is. They have to arise out of the same criminal episode, or they must be crimes that are related to one another, like four counts of robbery on separate days. We would charge those together, and that would be proper under the statute. Or if we have an event where a person commits five different crimes, we're required to put that under the same charging instrument. So most of our cases are that way. Most of our cases are prosecuted where we have a defendant who's committed multiple offenses during the course of the criminal episode. I would say thousands, hundreds of thousands maybe. We prosecute 20,000 cases a year in Multnomah County alone.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman? So let me just make sure I'm clear. The idea that an activity by a defendant results in multiple crimes being asserted by the prosecution is absolutely common. It happens all the time.
Yes.
Right? Okay. My question is, how many of those circumstances, with your collective experience, have the same level of, I guess I would say, social attractiveness that we heard today? The idea that, look, I did this one thing, and it maybe led to three or four crimes being committed, but it was one act that I did. It's the one single act that got those three or four crimes committed. Is that a common experience, or do people do multiple acts and then get multiple counts?
Chair Barker, Representative Vial, the best way to answer that is that I think that the more serious your conduct is, the more charges you're going to get. So as a supervisor of the misdemeanor team, I get everything from the most simple shoplifts to, you know, DUI, assault force, menacings, which is, that's kind of my spectrum. Now, I've worked in every unit in our office, but I now supervise, so everything comes through me. And as you get to the low-level offenses, the shoplifting and so forth, you'll just get one count because that's simple. That's all you did. But as you get more serious and you get into the robberies and the other things, you're frequently running afoul of multiple violations of the criminal code. And so the numbers of those cases go up as the seriousness of your conduct does. That's the simplest answer.
That's helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Yeah, I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess the question that I have for you is, in this particular case, you were willing to take a plea bargain, right?
Chair Barker, yes. We make plea offers in every case. That's our standard protocol.
Okay.
We make, I call it sort of the first salvo. We make the first offer typically, almost in every case. And then there's some negotiations that go back and forth where we find out more information about the individual than we can tell from reading the report. So we make an offer based on the criminal history and reading the reports. If there's a victim involved, there's victim impact. And then we make sort of that, this is what I think is appropriate for these facts. Then we get educated by the defense attorney who brings in more information, and there's a back and forth.
Follow up. So I guess this is a little bit outside of what happened here, but what's different about somebody getting a 3-year expungement and a 10-year expungement? Are the people different? Do they act different? Is there a reason to only have some at 3 and some at 10, I guess is my question for you, if you're able to answer that.
And we're kind of running against time right now, but that's fine.
Statute. Yeah. The statute dictates which ones.
Okay.
You know, if you have one qualifying one, you can get it done in 3. 2 bumps you up to 10 years, again, if it's a qualifying for some particular crime.
So
some can't be expunged ever, right?
Yeah. Right?
But for those that can, it's the number of convictions that you get.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I do want to make one correction.
Okay.
The rape case that I was describing, the trial court denied the motion to set aside. He appealed, and that motion was also denied at the Court of Appeals level, and so the rape 3 convictions remain.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Rhett Frazier, Jason Thompson, and Mary Sell.
– Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee, vice chairs. My name is Mary Sell. I am with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I do understand that you have a very full docket, and so we're going to try to be about 5 minutes, and I'm starting that now.
Appreciate that.
First off, we have not seen the amendment. We're willing to look at that, but we still want to address the bill because we do believe that it's good policy. And so thank you to Representative Kenmore, or Kenmore rather, and also it sounds like Mr. Breams has quite a story and has turned his life around, and so we appreciate hearing about that as well. I'm going to move this right along to the two gentlemen that I brought with me today who are experts and can and who are going to talk to you very briefly about this.
Great, please.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Rhett Fraser. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon. I'll try and be very, very fast. I know that there's a parity bill that's going to be discussed, and that's a very worthy subject as an ex-public defender.
Thank you.
I began my career in the Multnomah and Washington County public defender's offices. Since going into private practice in 2012, part of our practice is handling expungements exclusively. That means we probably file around 200 a year in all counties in Oregon. So I've had a pretty good survey. We've heard from Clackamas County, Multnomah County. I filed in all of them. And we probably field five times as many calls as we file. The majority of people who call are actually ineligible for one reason or another. I believe this is a good law here and a good proposal that's being put forward to the committee. My experience has been for many of the people who are going to be eligible for expungement, they've earned their way to that. They've successfully completed probation. They've paid restitution. They've remained crime-free. They've completed the full sentence of the court. And the statute provides if they're revoked from probation, they wait 10 years anyway. And then there's also certain protections later on the statute for crimes like unlawful use of a weapon that we heard of. That has to go before a judge, and the judge has to make clear findings that are written if the person's not going to get it. So there are special occasions. My experience has been with expungements. Most people contact us because there's a triggering event in their life. They want to go to school. They want to get a nursing license. They want to have housing. They want to get funding for going to college. For many of these people who want to do that, they come in and I have to give them the bad news that unfortunately, when they rode the TriMet Max without a ticket, they were also trespassed. They pled to two counts because all counts are charged in many, many counties and they're ineligible for 10 years. The facts of what they did are the same as someone who had a defense attorney plead them to one. It also, of course, discourages people from going to trial because they know that they're risking seven extra years of potentially being a convicted felon. It happens numerous times. We get calls from teachers. We get calls from nurses. We get calls from people who work for the forestry department. I got a call yesterday from a student who is completing his MBA at Portland State. I had to tell him, I'm sorry about your shoplift and trespass conviction. You pled to two. You have to be a felon for three more years. Even though he's earned his way back from that, it makes no sense to the people who speak with me on the phone. I don't want to eat up all of the time, but I'm happy to answer any questions about how this plays out for people. I'll give it to Mr. Thompson. This is a good bill. Thank you for your consideration of it.
Thank you for those the brief explanation.
Jason Thompson, I'm a criminal defense attorney here in Salem, prior district attorney in Multnomah and in Marion County. In Marion County, I actually handled the expungements for the district attorney's office here, came up with the checklist in a somewhat of a relatively complicated statute to try to make it simple for law clerks and those others that could look at it. I'm in support of this bill for three reasons. Number one, from an equal protection standpoint, I think really what we have is we have someone who has one level of representation and someone who has another level of representation getting a very different result on the expungement side. So, for example, one person comes into my office and they say, hey, I need to get this expunged. I had this incident, a lot of times domestic violence. We see it in where there's an assault for conviction and a harassment conviction. Well, unfortunately, you pled to both, and so you can't. Another person comes in. They had a defense attorney who was a little bit more creative, maybe did a deferred sentence on one of those, and now that person's eligible. Why are those two people being treated differently, you know, at year four? 5, 6, all the way up to 10. It doesn't make any sense. From a post-conviction standpoint, you typically, and I know that sounds a little odd, but typically a defense attorney is not obligated to talk to someone about expungements when they're working on resolving a case. However, if they do and they are wrong, then that is something that can be raised in a post-conviction setting. So, for example, take that same hypothetical I just had. If that person had actually, you know, taken that plea because of that and that was wrong advice, now that leads to a post-conviction claim, okay? Sometimes that can be very expensive, much more expensive than just filing the filing fee for an expungement. The other and final point, it's a little bit odd to probably hear me say this, but again, my same hypothetical, it's not really an accurate reflection. In other words, if I have a client who has pled to an assault and did a deferred sentence on a harassment, for those 3 years, their criminal history might not actually be accurately reflected just because we were negotiating with the state in some sort of plea negotiation. Now, if that meant that in, you know, year three, both of those convictions could come off, then for those 3 years when that person was convicted, it would be a more accurate reflection of what that person's true criminal history was. So I am in support of this bill. I think it's something that's long overdue. We could talk about all the different war stories from down the road, but there are many more people that come into my office that, just like Mr. Frazier, where we have to say, sorry, you know, we can't do it because you're not eligible, as opposed to, and those are usually for, you know, minor misdemeanors. There's a lot of other safeguards in the statute already. Thank you, unless there are any other questions.
Question? And I'll just say one thing, too. We're looking forward to seeing the amendments, and hopefully those aren't too restrictive in that they would, some people may be less able to go through some of those things, the education and so on, if you're poor. And so we'll have to take a real close look at that before we consider that amendment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
One more thing here.
We aren't voting here, but to be fully in disclosure, Mr. Bream is one of my former students at Mount Hood, so just so you're aware.
That's a big class of people you want to hear.
Yeah, but I just wanted to, you know, because I was like, yeah, I know him, so.
Okay, well, that's fine. Thank you for bringing that up. Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2698 and open a public hearing on, which one is it here? 2561.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2561 requires the Public Defense Services Commission to adopt a policy compensating appointed counsel at a rate commensurate with a deputy district attorney practicing in the same county who has equivalent experience. The bill prohibits the PDSC executive director from negotiating a contract that pays appointed counsel or a staff member working for appointed counsel at a wage less than the comparable deputy district attorney or staff member employed by district attorney. There is a dash one amendment that makes some minor language changes. It employs language consistent with a contractual relationship instead of an employment relationships, and we do not have the necessary paperwork to move the bill today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Madam.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I am Jennifer Williams, and I am the state representative for House District 36. For those of you who have served on this committee for any amount of time, you will recognize that this is my third time at this dais with this bill to extend parity in pay between our district attorneys and our public defenders. In 1963, the Supreme Court unanimously upheld our right to counsel as a fundamental right under the Sixth Amendment. There's a reason that Lady Justice is blindfolded and that her scales are equally weighted. It is important that our criminal justice system be seen both by those in it, those involved in it, and by the public as something that we can have faith in, and that the system is not disadvantaged on one side or the other for both the state or the defense. This bill, I think, recognizes that. I will say, because the co-chair of the Public Safety Committee is sitting here, that I recognize our difficulties with our budget. But like I said, I've brought this bill now. This is the third session because I believe this is a long-term structural problem that we need to address in this state to ensure that we are meeting our obligations in truly providing a right to counsel in the state of Oregon. This bill does a couple of things. It requires the Public Defense Services Commission to adopt policies to provide for equal compensation with equivalent staff between district attorney's offices and our public defense. It prohibits the executive director of public defense services from negotiating a contract that would include compensation at a rate less than that of equivalent district attorneys. And the intent is also to apply to support staff so that we are funding our district, or we are funding our defense side offices in the, with the same kind of resources that we do with our district attorneys. So with that, I will turn it over to the true experts, but thank you all for listening for the third time in a row.
Chair Barker, do you want me to proceed?
Please, please okay. do. I'm sorry.
Let me see if I get some assistance turning this on. To show you the updated chart that we brought 4 years ago. Chair Barker, thank you, members of the committee. My name is Lane Borg. I'm the executive director of Metropolitan Public Defenders. And I want to talk to you. You're going to hear other people testify today about or present about how low pay has affected them. This chart you're seeing is an updated chart of one you saw 4 years ago. In blue, and it drops a little bit off there, maybe that's indicative of my age, it's my entire career. I started practicing law in 1984, and it goes through now how the where we were at in blue compared to the district attorneys and how that has changed over time, so that the top end of my scale, and we are a union shop. We negotiate with a bargaining unit with AFSCME, and where you can see where the top end of my shop, my scale for attorneys is just barely above the beginning. But I want to talk to you about a different aspect of why this is an important bill and why I'm in favor of it to change the system that we have. But I want to take you back because the problem of an underfunded system is caustic and it's hurting public safety. First, we've designed a system of indigent defense around the lowest bid model, with the quality standard being something just above was it horrible. Our current rates started from an old OJD study in the 1990s that looked at the lowest bid for how they would who would bid to do that, who would get a charge for a DUII or an assault or a theft. Well, we've certainly made changes that are these are mostly incremental to that original method. And OPDS has strived to make funding changes, but given the small amount of money invested, those changes have also been incremental. And the standard of quality I referenced from the Supreme Court case Strickland, it really is a question in layman's term of was the defense horrible? It's not a high quality bar. It's not something we should be striving to. So when you combine a low bar and a lowest bid method, we should not be surprised at this shocking disparity that we see in our system. We have designed the system that way. So how have we survived? As bad as the disparity is, clearly folks have lived and eaten. My people have survived. But most of what we've mostly done is we've monetized failure. Across the system, we find ways to finance people not showing up. I get paid whether the person comes to my office or whether it's a one-week trial. I get paid the same amount. If everybody showed up, I would be overwhelmed. I couldn't do the work we've done. We've monetized that into the system, the failure to appear rate. If the current trial rate, which is something less than 10%, was doubled or tripled, it would still be well below the 50% rate. And I think that surprises a lot of people how many cases. There were discussions on the prior bill about plea bargaining and how much plea bargaining. And it's quite an understatement to say we make a plea bargain in every case. They make a plea bargain in every case because 90 to 95% of the cases are plea bargained. But if you doubled or tripled that, we wouldn't be here talking about public defender pay. We'd be building two or three, you know, we'd be doubling or tripling the courthouse building, the hiring judges. It would just overwhelm the system if that had happened. But we have squeezed every dollar we can out of this process over the 30 or so years that we've been adopting this model of lowest bid, squeeze it out, monetize failure. On my particular end of the business, what you've done is that you've designed a system that favors doing a bad job. Even taking so many, because the only way you're going to make more money is take more cases. Increase your caseload if you want to get more money. And that has, even if you're well-intended, you're not going to be able to do the work to set your clients up for success. You're going to be just churning cases out. An economist looking at this would say you have a perfectly efficient system. Take more cases, plea them out, don't do the work, because you're not being paid for that. You're not being monetized for that. You're doing that out of your own goodness of your own heart. Second thing that I think this addresses is equality is quite literally the DNA of our republic. We split from England because of inequality. We fought a civil war because of inequality. We have tried to change our segregated society and schools because of inequality. Our justice branch literally uses the symbols of the scale of justice because we value equality so highly. But paying public defenders 35% or more less just simply is not equality. It's time to step up, apply this concept to public defenders, to public defense, and if we do not, because if we do not right the scales of justice, we're not just tipping those, we're tipping the ship of state. We're starting to affect the public safety system because people are not able to do the work that we know they should be doing to set our clients up for success rather than for failure. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Crabtree, Mr. Weiner, and I think Horn.
I've already spoken.
Okay.
Let's see, the bottom one is mine. Yeah.
Chair Barker, committee members, Representative Williamson, thank you for this bill. This is an important bill. Lane Borg hit on many of the reasons that this should be passed. Inequality is rampant in our system. I've been the head public defender in Bend since 1981, the first time that I dealt with parity as an issue.
And I need your name on the record.
I'm sorry, Tom Crabtree.
Thank you, Tom.
First time I dealt with parity with the DA's office was in the mid-80s when the difference between our salaries was $5,000 a year for starters. What I've provided here is an example of two actual people. One was an attorney in our office who went over to the DA's office to get an additional $17,000 a year to start. That we replaced him with a person at this beginning of our scale. And the deputy DA, let's just call him Rich. And Rich started out at $69,000 a year, and he got a cost of living increase and a merit increase every year. For 7 years till he got to the top of his scale. In 2013, he was making $107,000 a year, and aggregated over the decade, he made $952,000. Our replacement attorney, let's call him Matt. Matt started at $43,000 a year. And the way we're funded in our contracts, we get a biennial contract. There is no increase in the middle year of that until, you know, this last year. We are not funded for step increases. We can either give a cost of living increase or a step increase. And as Yogi Berra would say, we get our annual increases every other year. That Matt started out at $43,000. The legislature in the 2007 session gave indigent defense a significant boost. We were able to raise our salary scale to $60,000 that year to start. Even then, we're $12,000 behind the DA's office. And so Matt's progression, you can see in blue there, that ends up by 2016 at $76,000, and his combined salary for the decade of $656,000, a difference of almost $300,000 in that decade for doing the same kind of work. Over a 35-year career, that's over $1 million difference for the same work. John Hummel, the district attorney for Deschutes County, who started out in my office as a deputy public defender, agrees that there should be parity between pay between DA's office and public defenders. It's as if, say, the majority party said, hey, we're more popular with the voters. Let's vote ourselves a 35% pay increase if you're in the majority party. Is that equitable? Certainly not. What if they said, well, the heck with International Women's Day yesterday, let's pass a bill that says the men get 35% more than the women in our minimum wage bill. Is that equitable? No, but that's what we have. That's what this system is, and it makes it increasingly difficult to keep people in a job, to retain them, to attract them in the first place. We're now over $21,000 difference between a deputy DA and a public defender. We have people doing Measure 11 cases in my office who make less than they would as a starting salary in the district attorney's office. That is inequitable. This bill addresses that inequality. There's been some talk of the expense of this. Representative Williamson referenced that. The last estimate I saw was $21.5 million, which sounds like a lot. I like to look at that as 1.9 Helfriches. And for that, you get hundreds of people who are actually willing to work for that money. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is John Weiner, W-E-I-N-E-R. I currently serve as the executive director of the Marion County Association of Defenders, or MCAD. We are a consortium of approximately 30 attorneys who provide the majority of the public defense services in Marion County. I have my technological know-how here. Okay. Oh, thank you. If there's an 8-year-old somewhere. That's all right. Okay. So if we could go down just a little. Yeah, down a little bit more. There we go. Okay, yeah, that last thing. We're okay. That's probably the best angle. Before we go delve into the graph, and I'll be brief, I just want to make sure that it's understood that nobody in our defense community in Marion County begrudges the district attorneys any of the compensation that they have. They are a critical part of the system. And in Marion County, we're actually really blessed to have a good relationship with the district attorney's office. Walt Beglau does a fantastic job. He's very forward-thinking. And so in no way, shape, or form am I saying that they don't deserve what they got. So just putting that out there. What you have before you here is a bar graph. And so what this does is it compares the compensation for four different relevant groups of attorneys in Marion County. In 2015, the Marion County District Attorney's Office, they did a job posting. It's just a random, you know, garden variety entry-level position, and the range was $58,000 to $78,000. So that's entry level Marion County, $58,000 to $78,000. I couldn't find last night at midnight a newer one, unfortunately, but that's the posting that I have. And those two red bars, they represent that range. So the one on the very left red bar is $58,000, and the taller red bar is $78,000. The blue bars represent what is the range of what you could reasonably expect to make at the Marion County Associated Defenders, or MCAD. And those, the amount varies. There are two variables there. One is how much staffing you want to have, and two is how badly you're willing to abuse the sort of nationally accepted caseload standards. So let's say the lowest, the minimum for MCAD, is that short blue bar represents what you would make if you strictly adhered to the national standard and you had one full-time associate. And that is $32,000, I believe. The top bar, which is the most you're going to really realistically be able to make at MCAD, this is after expenses and things like that, and I used state figures for, I think, $17.17 for legal help, which is about the 40th, 30th percentile or something for Marion County. That's from the Employment Department. The most you're going to make really ever is a little under $73,000 by the time you subtract for rent, PLF, bar dues, staples, light bulbs, all that kind of stuff. And so that's what you have. The blue bars are the range you could expect to make at MCAD. The red ones are DA1 from 2 years ago. And as you can see, that the top range of the entry-level DA1 is, I mean, you some of those people are going to get hired at more than you would ever make after working 30 years at MCAD. That, to me, seems startling, but that's just, you know, that's one comparison. So those are the red-blue comparisons. Now over the other three sets of bars, that compares, the green are the Marion County District Attorney compensation, and the purple ones are all private public defense, all private criminal defense providers, attorneys in Marion County, and that includes people like MCAT attorneys, and it also includes people like Mr. Thompson who do this work on a retained basis. And you can see if you take those green bars, those are percentile ranks. So if you're in the leftmost green bar, you're making less than 75% of the Marion County DAs. And if you're in the middle green bar, you're, of course, making more than 75% and the 95th percentile similarly. And you can see for the criminal bar, the three corresponding levels of compensation. And I think the top, if you're in the 95th percentile for the private bar, you're making $327,000. And if you're in the 75th percentile, I believe that's $211,000. And I'm not sure the 25th percentile, the purple bar, maybe some part-timers in there. I'm not sure. Nancy Kozine, the executive director of the OPDS, pointed out that possibility. So I think the real two data points are the right two sets of bars. So you can see that there is a significant difference. If you look at the 25th, I'll say one more thing about the bar. Look at the 25th percentile of the DAs, right? So that is right just about a couple thousand dollars less than you're ever going to make as an MCAT attorney, period. And so if you do things and you – and that, by the way, that's 20%. That's abusing the caseload standard by 20%. So if you're going to take only a misdemeanor caseload, the maximum accepted figure is 400 in a year. So I'm letting people take 480 because if I stick to 400, nobody's going to be available to take my cases. Nobody's going to be there to do the job. And that's really speaking – that's getting toward more of I think what Lane Borg was talking about and even Jason Thompson. But I'll move on to that in a minute. Anyway, that's the bar graph, and I think you can make some interesting comparisons when you compare that tall and the short blue bar to all those other sets of attorneys. So we've got, as you can see, attorneys that have been practicing 25, 30 years, making maybe the tall bar. And that was, by the way, those red bars, those are from 2015. And so I'm assuming, I think it's safe to assume that they're just a little bit taller now. The net result of this, of course, is that our attorneys take too many cases, that they have to do that to stay in business and pay things like student loans and their kids' braces and all that. Also, it's a problem for retention. I had a bar bulletin, an Oregon State Bar Bulletin ad for several months, and I didn't get any takers. And then we did some months we do, and several months, many months we don't. It's hard to keep people when you compare what you're making to what the purple people make there. You don't have to be a financial genius, coming out of law school to figure that one out. There is absolutely a critical link between pay parity and the quality of representation. Obviously, we're not talking about people getting rich here. We're talking about criminal defense attorneys that represent one of the most vulnerable segments of the population, taking reasonable caseloads to provide constitutionally adequate representation. And I think it was Lane Borg that talked about, are you truly terrible? That's the post-conviction standard. I actually do a lot of post-conviction standards, post-conviction cases for the state. And the standard is that no reasonable attorney would do it. So if there, you have to prove that no reasonable attorney would have done, or usually it's would not have done. No, that's not true. Would have done, and usually the post-conviction cases come from attorneys who are too busy, so they don't do the investigation. Failure to reasonably investigate is by far the most common error made, and you have to. I mean, no reasonable attorney. That's a hard standard to say that no reasonable attorney wouldn't have done this. Once that mistake is made at the trial level, it's really hard to get it reversed. And so the difference in compensation between district attorneys and their opposing counsel is critically important. When you overfund, or when the DAs make significantly more, forget DA, just general litigation. Side A gets paid significantly more than counsel for side B. Who do you think is usually going to win? Right? We don't have to be law professors. I'm certainly not, to sort of figure that out. Of course, the outcomes are going to be skewed when you fund one side of any kind of litigation, divorce, personal injury, more than you fund the other. You're going to get more talented people. You're going to get people that can take fewer cases, that can do the representation better. The people that need public defense attorneys, they get people that are overworked and underpaid, period. You know, would you rather have people in the blue, just if you don't know anything about them, would you rather be represented by somebody that's one of the blue people or by Mr. Thompson? And I don't want to even think where he might be on the purple scale, but it's an inequity, and it's only because you make less money and you don't have the money to retain somebody who can take 100 cases a year. So obviously, we feel that this is I guess the last thing I'll say is there is a social, of course, and financial cost to this disparity. You have Oregon citizens who are going to prison for stuff they didn't do. You have people going to prison for many, many, many more years than they should. And I think it was Mr. Thompson that talked about the difference in the expungement, different levels of representation. Of course, it results in a different outcome. And you have this... this is a long-standing problem. It was described as structural. It's not something that can be remedied by an incremental increase over a series of biennia. It is structural, and the whole idea of public defense funding has to be changed. This has to stop. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, and thank you, Vice Chair Williamson, again for this bill. My name is Deanna Horn, and I am a public defender. I'm lucky enough to work for Lane Borg at Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, and I love my job. And I'm emotional about it. I'm sorry. I can feel that coming. I've been a public defender for 14 years. I engage in triage. I look at the files that come across my desk, understanding and knowing that those are people with real lives. They're members of our community. They are more often people of color. I represent more people of color than are represented in the Multnomah County population. And I have to make choices. What kind of representation does this person get? How much time am I going to spend preparing for a trial for this person? How often can I go to the well that is my legal assistant and ask her again to please fend off my client's family who are worried about them? Because they're represented by the public pretender. After 14 years, that one still hurts. Because I do love my job, and I love my clients. While I do engage in triage, I also engage in specialty sometimes. I can negotiate more or less, the mental health system in Multnomah County, although it's kind of a morass sometimes, and my clients get lost there. I can negotiate the probation department in Multnomah County because of the experience that I have and how long I've been there and the context that I've learned. I know who to call at the jail to try to get some help for a client who's maybe suffering with mental illness or a medical issue. But that's because I've been able to be there for 14 years and I've made those contacts. Part of the reason I've been able to be there for 14 years is because I have a supportive partner. And we've chosen to not have a family. Because we couldn't possibly afford. We have the dog and the cats, that's the family. We couldn't make another choice. I could have given up my job. But my partner understands and recognizes how much that is a core of my identity. And so, you know, he works overtime to make sure that we're paying the bills and that I'm, after 14 years, with my $80,000 in student loans that I'm still paying on, having a proud graduate of the University of Oregon Law School, having gone to a public university and receiving a really great education there, if I can just say, there are choices that I've made in order to stay. My work is undervalued by the state of Oregon. My clients are undervalued by the state of Oregon. I am part of the public safety system, and that system is undervalued by the state of Oregon. And that's not right. So I urge an aye vote.
If you will briefly, because we're going to have to go here.
Just real quick question. How many more cases would go to trial if there were parity?
That's a hard question. I think if we had lower caseloads, you know, the percentage would go up a certain amount. But in my experience, when you go to trial with the DAs, when you beat them a few times, when you show them that, you know, you're serious about what your offers are, what you're willing to accept, that the offers get better. And so it evens out after a period of time. I don't think the trial rate would double. I think there might be a bubble where it goes up a little bit, but when they realize, you know, they're not coming out as good as the offers that they've made, the offers get better because they have limited amounts of resources as well. You know, there are greater resources than we have, but, you know, they don't have the ability to try 25% of their cases either.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. And the carbon paper on today's witness sign-up isn't very good, so Charlie somebody, Autumn and Sean, I think, McCray.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mr. Chairman, co-chairs.
Thank you. And I want to give everybody as much time as possible, but we are a little bit pressed. I let that other one run a little too long.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. It's Pearson, P-E-I-R-S-O-N.
Okay, thank you.
I am a public defender. I work in Portland. I work for Multnomah Defenders. Today's my anniversary. My partner and I want all of the same things that a young couple want. And that's a home and a family. And that's not a crazy dream. But I am frankly worried that I will ever be able to achieve that if I stay in this job. My partner has a son. He is 8. He loves Lego, and he loves Star Wars, and he loves his mom, and that is all right with me. The three of us talk about moving in together, and I am frankly scared that I'm ever going to be able to afford a 2-bedroom apartment in a decent neighborhood with access to good schools. I can't really speak to how it is in other counties, but in Multnomah County, the state of Oregon is getting an incredible deal on services for indigent defendants. My take-home pay is about $3,000 a month, which every time I see it, still looks like a lot. I grew up pretty poor. But that's not house money. That's not living in Portland money. After my bills and after paying the interest on my student loans, which is frankly all that I can pay, there's little left to save. I actually sat down and did the math last night, and over the last 30 days, I've worked enough that it comes out to about $15.58 an hour. We are dedicated to our jobs. We are good lawyers. We are creative. We work hard. We care about our clients, and that's why we do this. But we also, in Multnomah County, represent about 80% of the people who are charged with misdemeanors. We're not just other people's lawyers. We're everybody's lawyers. And we are not accorded the respect that district attorneys are. And we know that, and that's frustrating, and it's tiring. It is heartbreaking to hear the things that my clients say to me, because they know too. I don't know where they hear it. I don't know who they hear it from, but the word is out. They know that we don't make district attorney money. And, you know, I get asked, you know, if this is something that I'm required to do before I get to go be a DA. I've had clients, more than a half dozen, tell me that they wished that they could fire me and go hire a real lawyer. And that breaks my heart. Not because I feel disrespected, because I don't. I'm here for them, and that is frustrating for them. It is heartbreaking for me because they don't feel like we as a society care. When we spend two-thirds as much money helping them defend themselves as we spend trying to put them away, that tells them really clearly what our priorities are. I went to law school for this. This is what I want to do. This is my calling. I believe in public service. I always have. But if I have to choose between my calling and having a home of my own, I'll leave. I know that I'm not the only one either. I have only been doing this for a few years, but I've been watching experienced mid-career public defenders walk out the door the entire time. If you spend, you know, 5-6 years doing this, you will have seen pretty much every kind of criminal case. You will have spent time in front of every judge. You'll have dealt with every DA in your county. You'll have moved clients through every different kind of diversion program. You will know the system. And that's incredibly valuable on an open market. And for-profit firms are looking for it. And they will treat mid-career public defenders like the valuable commodity that they are. And we lose them. This bill is not asking for the moon. It's not asking for PERS. It's not asking for something irresponsible. It's asking for parity. We're asking that you help us make public defense something that a great lawyer can do for their entire career. We're asking you to help us keep the lawyers that we train so that the huge numbers of people that we represent can count on us and never have to question our qualifications. I urge an aye vote. Thank you.
Representative Barker, Vice Chairs Representative Olson and Representative Williamson, thank you for having this hearing. I was here last year. My name is Autumn Shreve, and I work for Multnomah Defenders with Mr. Pearson, and I've worked there for just under 2 years at this point. I did previously work here at the legislature for Representative Greenlick, who sadly is not here today. So I want to parrot some of the things that Mr. Pearson said, which are that people get more experience by doing the job longer.
I am one of the most experienced misdemeanor-level attorneys at our office, and I've been there just under 2 years. We've hired 5 new attorneys at my office that did not have previous criminal defense experience since I was hired. So those people all built up caseloads, took them slowly over time. I've submitted written testimony that talks about this as well. I won't belabor it, but the new cases that come in get trickled into those people's caseloads, and everybody else has to pick up the slack. And it's fine because we know what we're doing a little bit better. I can prepare for a trial pretty quickly. I prepared for 4 trials 2 weeks ago. Some of them ended in motion, some of them got plead on the day of trial. Regardless, I prepared for them. A year ago, it would have taken me 2 or 3 times as long to prepare those same cases. So my experience is helping my clients. My experience is helping my colleagues to not have to pick up my slack. And my experience is helping the court system run more efficiently, that the judge doesn't have to hold my hand. The DA doesn't have to slow things down. The court staff is happy with the documents I give them, and it doesn't slow them down. All of the things that I bring are valued. However, coming here today is a time where I have to have a humbling experience where I don't know everything I need to know to do this job. I'm just now starting to pick up felony cases and starting to learn the ropes of that, which I think is going to take several more years to get experienced with felony cases and to really feel like I'm helping my clients. Because of that, I'm here to say that I don't know everything. I don't do the best job for every single one of my clients. Me and my friends, and I say my friends because Charlie and the rest of my colleagues that do the same work as me, we spend all of our time together. We are at the office. For the last 2 nights, there's been at least 2 or 3 people there until 9 and 10 o'clock at night. I was there till 11 o'clock at night on Tuesday night. So we're there all the time. We're working for our clients all the time, but I'm not doing everything. And we constantly say we could be doing more, but it's just too much. So if I knew more and I was quicker and I had the type of experience that Ms. Horn has, that she just went through, all the things that she can do so much more quickly, I would be more of an asset. And it would be worth the state paying us more to keep us there. Because right now, the state is paying for a training ground of new attorneys coming in. You don't come out of law school knowing how to try a case. You just don't. And so at this point, the state is funding this training ground, and then the people are going into private practice. The reason we've hired so many attorneys is that it turns over. And to our director's credit, Keith Rogers, he is fine with that. He doesn't begrudge people going to find more money, but it does slow down the process. And it has been the status quo for a while, and I think people have just gotten used to it. So I have the same things that everybody else has said. I have the $200,000 in debt. I have to pay the $500 a month towards my student loans. I rent. Most of my friends have bought a car recently once they could afford it. Many of them don't own cars. Some of them sleep in the office floor. So it's we're doing our best, but it being a public defender and being a criminal defense attorney is by its very nature a humbling experience because you are in the least powerful position. And coming here and saying I'm not doing everything I can and I wish we could do more is also a humbling experience. I think this bill is very important, and I urge we pass it out of committee.
Thank you. And I don't think there's anybody here that doesn't think that the public defenders are underpaid. Please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Sean McCray. Since the early 1980s, when I was a law student, I was a member of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. In October 2016, I became the executive director. In between, I tried criminal cases throughout the state of Oregon and in the federal courts. I also served for 15 years as the vice chair of the Public Defense Services Commission, which allocates the funds to the various public providers. And for the year of 2016, most of it I served as chair until I took over the OCDLA position. As a practitioner, I have seen how things go in all the counties in the state in terms of criminal defense lawyers and juvenile practitioners, and they do a very good job. They are so dedicated, and they are true believers in our system, which is why they do it. On the commission, I learned about the system and how we do things and how it works and how it fails and how we have a problem with the graying of our defense bar, my exception, but only my hairdresser knows for sure. And we have to be looking toward the future about how we are going to obtain and retain new lawyers who can keep this great tradition of public defense. Our system, as you know, is an adversary system. That doesn't mean that we fight personally with the prosecutor, but it means that our jobs as criminal defense lawyers and juvenile practitioners is to test the prosecutor's story. And I want to give you just a brief example of a case that almost went to John Wiener for post-conviction relief. I had a client I represented who was charged with arson in the first degree. If she were convicted of arson one, she would have been looking at 90 months over 7 years in prison. And as I'm sure you know, that means no early release, no programs, and no good time. There was some pressure in this case. I looked at the police reports. I read the discovery. I talked to her. I told her, it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. She was adamant, she was insistent, and she was consistent that she was innocent. I got an investigator. I sent my investigator out to talk to people. I went and looked at the scene. It wasn't looking good. Things went on. I want to keep this short, but I determined that there was one witness listed in the police reports whose statement I did not have. I asked the prosecutor for that statement a couple of times, and the story is not intended in any reflection on the prosecution. This is on about the defense. I asked for that statement. I couldn't get it. I kept saying to the investigator, we got to find this guy. We got to make sure we have talked to every single person, because the client was so insistent that she was innocent. My investigator finally located this guy and was able to sit down and talk to him. It turned out that he was a good Samaritan, innocent bystander, just walking down the street, came upon my client, the defendant, and her boyfriend. The boyfriend was very upset. Innocent bystander's trying to talk the boyfriend down, can't do it. Boyfriend picks up a barrel planter, throws it through the window of a pizzeria, comes back to my woman defendant, grabs this little bottle of moonshine that she had, lit it on fire, and threw it into the pizzeria. Came back to her and told her, you better run. And she did. He completely confirmed her claims of her innocence. I went to the prosecutor. I provided this witness's statement. I got her out of custody, and eventually the charges were dismissed. But she spent over 30 days in jail for a crime she didn't commit. And listening to John Wiener talk about how an attorney's performance has to be horrible before there's post-conviction relief, I was sitting back there thinking, I did so much that she could have gotten convicted if I had said, look, we just don't have a chance. I've talked to everybody but this one guy, and, you know, he's probably not important, and got her to take some kind of a plea. And then later, the court would have said, well, you know, Ms. McRae did a lot of stuff. She did what reasonable attorneys would do. But that's not what we want or expect from our criminal justice and juvenile system. We want to know that we are having the story tested and that we're getting at the story under the story in cases like this. And that's why public defenders need, and juvenile practitioners, I don't want to leave them out, need time and they need money. They need time to be able to do investigation, to do analysis, to do research. They need the money, as you've heard, for their investigators, for their experts, for themselves, for a reasonable caseload, so we can have the ability to have those who are doing this work continue to do it, and those who are coming behind us to stick with us and keep the state great. Okay,
thank you. Thank you. Next, I have four more people signed up. Morgan Daniels, Eric Dietrich, Tom Colahan, and Jessica Campbell. It's already been said, we'd appreciate it. I have one more bill I have to do today real quickly. Okay, thank you. I don't want to cut anybody short, but we do need to.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, and committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2561. I'm Morgan Daniels. I'm an appellate public defender, and I'm president of the AFSCME Local 2435, which represents the appellate defenders at OPDS. I'm here on behalf of myself and on behalf of the members of our AFSCME unit. Before I came to appellate practice 7 years ago, I was a trial-level public defender in Umatilla County for 3 years. So I know firsthand the crushing caseload, the anguish over trying to divide up all of your time between all of your clients, each of whom deserves the best that you can give, but probably very few of them will actually get it because of that pressure. The nights and weekends that you give up doing the research, writing the motions that you didn't have time to get to because you had to be in court all week. We all signed up to work hard. Hard work is not what scares people, but none of us signed up to work hard and yet still be unable to take care of ourselves and our families adequately, unable to meet our debt obligations, unable to live sort of ordinary lives in, you know, cities and towns in Oregon. Pay parity between public defenders and prosecutors is necessary, and it's right. If Oregon doesn't commit to this effort, then Oregon cannot truthfully say that it's committed to justice and that it's committed to ensuring that the Constitution protects all of our people, not just the people who have money. We can't afford to keep kicking this one down the road. This is equal pay for equal work, and we need equal pay for equal work. I and the 40 appellate attorneys, nearly 40 appellate attorneys, public defenders at OPDS, strongly urge you to pass this bill out of committee, support it. We know that our sister and brother public defenders in the trial courts need relief. They need relief, and they need you to provide that relief. We're distressed by the shocking disparities that exist in pretty much every county. We have one too, but it's smaller. Give the bill an eye. Support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Tim Colahan. I'm executive director for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I just want to say that Oregon District Attorneys support the concept of pay parity. We know how important it is to have experienced practitioners on both sides, and compensation plays a great role in that, a huge role in that. And so we definitely are in support of this concept.
Thank you. And I just, one of the things you have to take a look at under labor law is requiring the district attorneys to negotiate the wages. I don't think we can quite do that by matching the same. It's clear that we've known this all along, how underpaid the defense public defenders are. I've seen that, and nationally it's even worse other places, which doesn't make it any better here at all. There's also the district attorneys are underpaid as well. Obviously nothing like you, but they have a turnover for the same reason. People move on out of there. And just one thought I've had after the O.J. Simpson trial, if he'd blown his knee out his sophomore year and wasn't living in Brentwood, he probably would have ended up with a public defender just trying to cut a deal so that he wouldn't face the death penalty instead of having the dream team there with all that money, which made all the difference in the world, which kind of, I think, says what's been said here today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can I make one more comment? Yeah. We don't have any more witnesses signed up.
No, but we have one more.
No, right. So I want to thank everyone for coming and testifying on this bill and just remind this committee that we hear bills over and over again about things like treatment court and justice reinvestment, and we're making actually public
we're making the defense job more complicated every time we do something to work with clients to get them the services they need, so they're not frequent flyers in that in the criminal justice system. And so as we continue to work through those things, we are making the job of the public defender much more like a social worker with the client and their family. And so it's something to keep in mind when we talk about other bills that this, you know, we're adding to the complication of these jobs.
All right. So I think that we also spend a lot of time focusing on disparate treatment of people who are low income or people of color in all kinds of laws that we pass, and you know, we can't not acknowledge that failing to pay public defenders adequately is really synonymous with contributing to the disparate treatment of disproportionately people of color and low income people. And so it's absolutely contrary to what we are trying to get done in the legislature, and hopefully this session we can make progress on this important issue. So thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And of course, that's who they're defending if they have money.
Exactly.
Going somewhere else. So yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill. Have a beautiful day. Which one is that? 2561. Right. And open a. We're not today. Okay. And open a public hearing on 2621.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2621 modifies the Crime Victims Compensation Program administered by the Department of Justice.
But I'll stay.
Okay.
Hello, old friend.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Shannon Savell. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Services Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. Very briefly, 2621 merely proposes to clarify language in the bill and create a couple of new programs to continue to move us into a more victim-centered focus for a program that is really the foundation and kind of safety net for some of the state's most marginalized people. Those are people who don't have insurance or other means of support and are victims of violent crime. In particular, it focuses on survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking, and tries to acknowledge the fact that due to our current understanding of brain science and the responses to trauma, that is a class of survivors and victims that typically are not going to easily fit into the confines of the statute, which would require them, ideally, to report within 72 hours, to fully and completely cooperate with the prosecution, et cetera. So I can go into more detail if you'd like, but.
And I'm good.
Okay. Great. Okay. Thank you very much. Testimony.
Aaron.
Close the public hearing on. Oh, I'm sorry. Sybil and Nikki.
We'll be very brief.
They're running.
Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Thank you very much for your support of this bill. We urge support from the Oregon Law Center's perspective. We echo Shannon's statements from the Department of Justice indicating that access to crime victim compensation is a huge issue for crime victim survivors, especially low-income survivors, often whether or not someone's eligible and has access to the Crime Victims Compensation Program really is the key in whether or not someone gets the assistance and compensation that they need. So, thanks. Okay,
thank you. Nikki Terziev here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, which is the technical advisor and trainer and kind of safety net, overarching program for safety net nonprofits around the state, including on tribal reservations and We Three.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, committee, for hanging around. We're adjourned.
Right.
Thank you, committee, for hanging around. We're adjourned.
Right.